All right, so motivation. So this idea of Penrose is really old. It was like in the 60s that the IG first put it up. And nobody would kind of work after he, I asked him like what he gave it up, and then he just said nobody else was working on it. Nobody was helping. And so he just gave it up until like his student in Zurich did a thesis on it in the 80s, and then he went out of physics, so and he's given up anymore. So I'm gonna tell you stuff which is really old, hasn't been done for a while. Now the properties of that space of quantized directions, which I find really cool. So first, it's quantum theory of geometry. So it's geometry, and it's somehow quantized already at the basis. And so therefore, who says geometry says gravity, and hopefully it might lead to some ideas for gravity. I think it already has, as a matter of fact. I think loop quantum gravity was was inspired partly from this idea. Now, what's really cool about it is so first of all, it's Van-Gogh independent, which many people like, but it's also topology independent, so you don't have these things that you have in spin forms and everything, where you have to sum over all topologies, which is kind of a nightmare. So you don't have to worry about topology or background, which is really good. And a really good thing is another good thing is that degrees of freedom are discrete, and all the mathematics are discrete. Like, and I really mean discrete, up to the point where you're not using real numbers or complex numbers, which might sound strange, because it's supposed to be quantum mechanics without complex numbers. But I'll show you how it works. One aspect, so this is more speculative, it's less obvious. But the dynamics and the measurements are somehow two faces of the same aspect. And this is really nice, because when you think about it, when you do a measurement, you're actually doing this. It is dynamic, right? You're moving something. And so therefore, there's some kind of resonance here to what real physics might be. So that's quite nice.
So regarding Penrose's work, is this distinct from like twister theory?
This is distinct from twister theory. Totally distinct. So I'll just quickly give a bit more motivation. So I know that most people have heard lots of things already as to why it might be interesting to have a discrete theory, a discrete geometry, and a discrete theory of a discrete geometry. So there's lots of motivations, especially including the quantization when first done with the loop quantum gravity, which is a big motivation. But I'll try to give a few more points here. So the first thing is that the current standard model, which we know, particle physics, so it tells us, and we experience it to be discrete. So we see particles, it's discrete, and we see discrete levels of energy. So the matter seems to be discrete according to our current experiments and our current theory. And according to general relativity, matter and geometry are intrinsically linked. So therefore, it would make a lot of sense if matter is discrete and they're linked through gravity, that geometry should also be discrete. It seems kind of awkward that one can be discrete and the other not, if they're going to be related somehow through gravity. And once you admit that, or once you decide that you want to have a discrete theory, meaning you have all the degrees of freedom and everything, it seems weird to say that you're going to have real or complex numbers, because these are not discrete. If you have discrete degrees of freedom, how can you get? I mean, you can never get like all the real numbers, right? So why would you need the real numbers in the first place? So it seems very attractive that you can have a theory without any real numbers or complex numbers. Okay, fast ask what the independent or kind of the question was raised in the previous talk. So just trying to improve the
room. Yep. Can you explain what you meant when you said that matter is discrete?
So we see particles, right? We see particles discrete. We don't see particles as we don't see like half a particle or we see them in quanta, right? And then we see that their energy levels are also quantized. Our matter seems to be discrete. We don't have the continuous that we have in classical mechanics. We had a continuous matter that we were dealing with fluids, which were continuous, and you could always divide them more and more. Whereas in the current standard model, you know, you have an electron, you know, you can't divide it. It's discrete. It comes from discrete channels.
Actually, from like a geometrical expression point of view, classical matter is discrete, whereas quantum matter is not discrete. That's just the other way around.
Sorry, did you mean?
You have levels of excitations, but like classically, particles are point particle. But
well, classically, I mean, when you do real like classical physics, you don't use particles, you use fluids, right? That's what you're dealing with. It doesn't really make sense to imagine.
Well, you can talk classically about part like electron or point like atom or whatever. But quantum mechanically, they are from a kind of a spatial point of view, they are not discrete.
So they are discrete, but they are kind of, what you mean is they're not localized.
Yeah, okay.
Which is a different issue. Yes. At least, I think it's. Okay, so to come back to the spin network, so we have two ingredients for a spin network. One is an abstract graph. Here you go, we got an abstract graph. Oops. Something like that. Usually much bigger. And then we need a group. And so here I'll take our group. Okay, that's actually the algebra, but whatever. We'll take an SU2 as our group in our particular case here. And so what you do, you've got your group and you've got your abstract graph. Well, first, you need to try to find the representations of your group. So suppose you have SU2, we'll be using the finite representations of SU2, which are labeled by half integers. Right, so you extract those representations of that group that you happen to be using. And you, that's supposed to be graph. So you mix the representations with the graph. Basically, you label all the edges of your graph with your representation. With one, so you can do it randomly, almost. With one caveat is that it must work at the vertices. So basically, the vertices must be invariant under the action of the group, which is what it means by they have to be intertwined. Yeah? So yeah, when we use SU2, did I turn it on? No, that's better. That's not. Okay. Yeah. So it's too loud.
Isn't it also for sparkle reasons? Andrew started with spin as his group, but we generalized it now, so you can do whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's basically the historical. So the first group which was used was SU2, which
is spin, right? This is the same thing as the spin of an electron is the representation of SU2, right? Whereas now you can use whatever group and it's so for historical reasons.
But today we call them group networks
So then you just label, as you can see here.
So in our case, seeing as we use SU2, you label them with the representations. And I'm just going to say this quickly, but the interpretation in this particular case, the significance of the spin is not exactly the same thing as what it is in loop quantum gravity. So First of all, these spins here, you can view them as, so when you have something, a line here, you can view it as a homomorphism or a projection from that representation to that presentation. And then when you have, for example, I have here two edges here that meet at a vertex and go out, so that can be understood as a homomorphism from the representation of spin one representation and spin one half representation into spin one half representation. So yeah, so all the not closed, like which have all the spin networks who have exterior edges can be viewed as these homomorphisms, and if they're all totally closed, then they're the homomorphisms of scale of spin zero onto spin zero, and so therefore they're just the same thing as scalars. They're isomorphic or whatever to a scalar because that's the only the homomorphism from spin zero to spin zero are just scalars. It's just a number. Okay. Now, and so in this particular case, it's not clear how one should interpret it. In loop quantum gravity, the number on the edges, whoops, yes, the number on the edges represents the area. So in our case, it's not clear what we should interpret it as a length or as an area. I think it's more helpful to see it as a length. But it could also be an area, and so therefore, if it's a length, then the length is this, right? So it's the square, the norm of the square of the length of the spin is its norm, so j squared. And
so that's what I'm saying. It's not like L, P, G. So it's not for this particular interpretation. It's not
clear. There's the notion of distance is not figured out yet, and therefore it's not clear. I mean, you could see it as area, or you could see it as area, in which case it would be this, like in LQG, or you could see it as length.
Not really larger, for some different complexes. Exactly. So now, yes. Now we want to see the scalar product,
how we can figure out scalar product with this. So basically, the way we see it is we see each part of the network as some part of the geometry, some section, some neighborhood of the geometry. And what we're going to be able to do will be to figure out what the angle between these different sections of the geometry will be. That will be our goal. We're going to be able to figure out what the angle between them will be. And how we do that is as follows. Suppose we have this part of the spin network here, with spin j here, spin k here, spin l here. Okay, then. As I said before, we can interpret this as that when the spin j, and so suppose this is the operator L, which gives the spin for this this particular part of the network. This is the operator J, operator K, which gives the spin for these parts of the network. We can interpret this thing here as meaning that L is equal to J plus K. So you have J plus K, and they come into L. So these are the quantum operators here. And from that, we can, just by squaring this equation here, we can deduce that the quantum scalar product between these two spins here is this. And of course, we know what the square here is. It's just L plus 1. And this is a minus, even though it's not very clear. So minus j, j plus 1, minus k, k plus 1. So we figured out here because we were able to figure make the, know what the scalar product between these two areas, so these two areas, these two neighborhoods of the network are part of the geometry, and they have a direction. So if you see them as an actual length, then they're pointing somewhere. Or if you see them as a face, they're also their normal is pointing somewhere. And the angle between, so depending on whatever you see it at. Oh, so, okay. You can see these things as actual little rods, for example, in which case they would really be lengths. No, not embedded. Relational graph, totally relational.
So the graph is relational.
Well, because they're related to each other. That's the whole point.
Related to each other. So
they have an angle between each other.
I would say the angle's irrelevant.
No, that's
as long as the order of the vertices is the same, then one graph and another graph are the same. The
no, because this is the geometry. It's building the geometry. This thing here is the geometry.
And so that's maybe you're confused in the sense that is the angle that corresponds.
This is space. This will be the space.
So is the angle that corresponds to the angle between the two legs somehow observable?
Yeah.
So how is that angle observed? What would you measure?
Well, you measure this one here. That's how you observe it, by having this one here. So supposing they were not related at all, then they'd be at 90 degrees. Each other. They're like in different spaces, but because they're related, they're building up space. This is totally relational.
I see.
So basically, having this thing here.
I mean, we're not embedding this graph in a space-time manifold.
No,
this is the word that I could use the space-time manifold to make. So if your graph is purely relational,
you're using this other part of the graph. To manage. So this is your space time. Well, except that there's no time in this particular case.
Well, space. Let's just give it space. So where is your space?
This is the space. The graph is the space. And to say, like, so I have this space here, right?
Yeah.
And so it's a space of direction. So it's like as if you had a sphere. Except it has more information than that. It could have distance. I'm just not clear how that fits in right now. So basically, you can say that this particular thing, right, corresponds to the J, corresponds to this point of the space, for example.
Yes.
And then this thing corresponds to this point of the space. So if they're not related, you don't see how they're related. But this thing here tells you that they're actually, the angle here between them is this thing, plus 1 minus j plus 1 minus k plus 1 over jk. That the cosine of the angle is this.
So perhaps you thought of Europe, can that be negative?
That can be negative, of course. So, and the fun thing about this is that, so the smaller your spin is, so the angle, it can only take a discrete value here. And the smaller the spin is, the least amount of values you can have. For example, if those were spin 1/2, they can either be parallel or anti-parallel, and that's it. Or they can be like at 90 degrees if they're not connected at all. And the higher the spin is, the more diversity of angles you get to have. So this is totally, totally relational. And so basically, this thing as such doesn't have a direction in space as such. It only has a direction relative to other things. And yeah, so I guess, so yeah, so I should have put that thing before. So here, from this thing, we interpret that as meaning that J plus K, the operators of, and the angle and the operators of these two things equals to this one. And just mathematically, we use this from the quantum mechanics. And okay, so this is what I wrote on the board here. Basically, I should have written this. So, if I name, if my operator j plus k, if I name that my operator here t, j, k, like this, right? That's the scalar product between them. Then the cosine of between these two angles is simply equal. So cosine j, k will be equal to the scalar product between them divided by the norm that of this operator. And the norm of this operator, if you calculate it, it happens to be, so this thing here happens to be j times k. It's a very fast calculation. So now, as long as things are related, so in this particular case, it's very easy to see that these two have this precise angle between them. If things, so for example, if I have one, if I have one spin here and one spin here, and they're not directly connected, you can generalize what we did here. If they're somehow connected somehow, if they're not connected at all, then as I said before, they have no relationship between each other, and so they're in different space. Well, they consist of different space, so they're orthogonal to each other. But if they're connected somehow here, but they're not directly connected to each other, they might not have a precise angle between them, but instead a probability distribution of the different angles between them. And so you can generalize this thing here just using the same thing, just basic quantum mechanics or angular, like quantized angular momentum math. And you can figure out, you know, what probability it is that they have such an angle between them, these two things. And just to show it, this, I'm not going to calculate this over here, but just to show that if you want to calculate the expected value of the cosine between them, it's this formula here. So you have this number here, and so these things are numbers, as I said before, because they're homomorphisms from spin 0 to spin 0, and therefore they're simply numbers. Okay.
So could you explain that again? I didn't follow. How do you get probabilities out of this? And
so
what is this?
Okay. So you can get. So okay. Maybe I guess I have enough time to maybe go a bit slower and into more detail. I'll go here. So if you see that when we see the spin networks as these homomorphisms, then you have that the following thing. M equals j minus k to j plus k. Okay. M, j, k, j, k. And this has to be 2m plus 1 here. Okay. So when you have, so this thing here is simply equal to m. It's simply equal to j and k. So it's just simply decomposing it into the subspaces of different angles. This thing here, you're simply decomposing it into the subspace in which it has this particular angle between them plus the subspace. These are a sum of projectors. And so in order to figure out if you want to get the average, so for example, if you want to get the probability which the cosine between them is L plus 1 minus j plus 1, well, this thing here, then you would just add
the K here, J here, put an L here in between. You basically add this thing here, but only the one, you link only the one with the L here instead of M. And you link it up after all the specific edges. So once you have this particular graph, W here with different, you have K, J, like this, and then you basically project out the L part, L, and you go back to K, J, like this. So that's basically just projecting out the L part. And you need the normalization to L plus 1. And then you have all these other things here. And so you basically, because you just want to get a number out of this, you basically link it with itself again, W like this, and then here you have normally the J, the K here, and the J. Okay. But like that, and then you divide by the same thing without the projection to have the actual total norm of the whole thing. So you basically project that you basically figure out what's the dimension of the space L. Where this one is actually of spin L compared to the spin of all the other possible directions, and so therefore this gives you the probability that the angle between these two is this, and this thing here, if you want to get the average, not the the average, or the mean angle between them. You basically take your projector, except at each projector, you multiply it by that basic angle, the cosine between them. So you multiply by this thing, like that. I'm not going to write it, it's going to be too big. And this happens, if you do the calculation, it happens to be equal to simply adding a 1 here and adding this multiplier here in front. And then, so that's basically the same thing as adding this thing multiplied by this thing here, and then you divide by all the other crap that you're not interested in, just so that you're renormalizing back and make sure you're only keeping the probabilities you want. So yeah, it's a bit hard to explain this like that, but so basically this gives you the average angle between two spins whom are connected. But basically, it's simply, I mean, I'm saying all this thing, but it might be harder to understand just like this because I'm not actually doing all the math here. But it's simply a generalization of this thing to more complicated spin, like far away. But it's simply the simple logic of recombination theory. So you get this, right? This particular part here, just to make sure I'm not. No, sure, it's not good enough.
This is it, right? So this stuff is basically just applying this stuff just repeatedly to a more interesting, and then you end up getting this stuff. It's getting this, it doesn't actually really help the comprehension, it's basically the same thing in the comprehension. Alright, so you have this. Okay, now for the dynamics. So maybe I can do like I did in the elementary section and actually ask questions. Suppose I have this thing, so this should be a lowercase j, because I use the uppercases for, I should use the uppercases for the representation, for the uppercases for actual operators. So suppose I have this this part of a spin network. And suppose, like right now, there's only this kind of this part is undetermined yet. Could anybody tell me? So, what's the how one could calculate? So first of all, what are the possible L's that can go here, and how one can calculate the probability that they should have a certain L there? Yeah. So the probability is really simple, right? If you have L here,
the subspace when you have
we should just put it inside.
Okay. When you have the subspace J cross K, right? This Hilbert space is a 2J plus 1, 2K plus 1 dimensional Hilbert space, right? So the probability that there's an L here, for example, will simply be the dimension of this subspace, which means that the total spin of these two added together is L, divided by the total dimension of the total subspace, of the total Hilbert space of this.
Call you the plus. Ask the question. So basically, you agree that this, right, this is equal to J plus K, right, this is like plus J plus K minus 1 plus and so on plus J minus K. Right? Everybody agrees with that? Yeah? Cool, we agree with that? Okay, so this is basically like just normal quantum mechanics. You have two spins, right?
You have two spins, 1/2. Their total spin can either be spin 1 or spin 0, right? And there's one thing of spin 0 and one thing of spin 1, right? And so the dimension of this one here, so suppose I have here L, the dimension of this one is 2L plus 1, the dimension of this subspace. So the probability that it's in this subspace is 2L plus 1 divided by the dimension of this subspace divided by the dimension of this whole subspace. Does that make sense? Yeah? No? Okay. I guess I'll continue because I don't have that much more time. Okay. So the answer basically what I just said here, so the question mark can be M, and like what you said, it has to be between J plus K and J minus K, absolute value of J minus K, and the probability that it's this particular M is this probability, so what I just said here. And so basically that's the idea that's going to be used for the dynamics. So it's going to be it evolves probabilistically. I have part of a spin network here, and then I want to add another, and it's incomplete, and I want to kind of evolve it. Of course, here there's no time, so you're just basically expanding the space. And then you can figure out the probability that it expands into such a fashion generalizing this rule here.
Yeah, of course. Because you're like all these, right? This is equal to this, fits in this one, right? So the dimension of this one is equal to the sum of the dimension of this one.
Maybe you could do a simple example like half-half, just four dimensional number space.
Half-half is four dimensional.
J equals half, K equals half.
Okay, yeah. So equals, right? So,
now what can M be?
So now M can be either 1 or 0. So I have 1/2 here, 1/2 here, right? These are two say electrons that go together. And then after something happens here, the total angular momentum is something. total angular momentum can either be 1 or 0. Now, it's going to be 1 with probability p1 will be the dimension of this thing, which is equal to 3, over the dimension of this whole thing, which is 4. And p0 will be equal to 1 over 4. Yeah.
It would have been nice if you would have done that in the talk earlier again.
Well, that makes it very clear, and it's quite interesting that you can sort of see the probability channels.
Okay. So yeah. So and that's how you basically evolve the number. So you have edges sticking out, and you want to add more. So you basically pick some randoms in. And you put it there, and you see, okay, what's the probability that this thing happens? So that's the dynamics. It tells you how it evolves. Of course, yeah, with the slight caveat, there's no time in here, but there's only enough directions. But that's the basic principle. And so,
So you also said that there is another assumption that each one of those states is equally probable. So you don't have any Hamiltonian or anything.
Yeah, so there's no Hamiltonian, which is very like non-quantum mechanics like.
So without that, you just have to assume that every possible single interaction is nothing telling you what the probability like.
So this tells you what the probability is.
With the relative probabilities of each final stage. So you just have to just
So this is dynamic, right? It tells you. It tells you what the probability of like growing this way will be as opposed to probably growing that way. Okay, so now more generally, and this is just simply basically applying the same logic as we just applied here, it's just more complicated. So suppose I have this initial state here, right, and I call this spin network S. And then I want to figure out the probability that at some after that spin network S grows into this spin network T, where I added the W here. This is W, so that's the probability then that using the same logic as previously, we get this thing, where the norm of T, or the norm of S, is simply, so if I have S here, and I have Y, like J1, JN, then norm of S is simply equal to, I plug S back into itself, J1, JN, like that. So basically, what this is, in terms of more intuitive, what this means is basically, what you're basically doing is you're taking, so on the numerator, you're taking the norm of the whole thing. And it's basically like taking the almost, like taking the scalar product between. So maybe I should do an example of this one too. It's basically like. So for example, in the first case, right? You add two one halves here. Right, and you're adding. It depends on how you add them. If you add them parallel, they're going to grow. And if you add them anti-parallel together, then they're going to become zero. And so basically, So you basically somehow. I have a hard time saying this. You're basically somehow taking the kind of dot producting. The two different parts of the spin network when they're put together, and that's T. And then you're dividing by the norm of each. And these things are just normalizations for the sticking out edges. So they're not, they're just for the normalization. Okay. Now for the semi-classical limit, how you manage to get some type of semi-classical limit under this. So the idea is, okay, so you have your spin network here, which represents your geometry. And what you want to do is you want to take, okay, so you separate it into big chunks here. And this thing here has a kind of total spin to it. And this thing here has a total spin to it. This thing here has a total spin to it, and so on and so forth. And what you want to do is you want to make sure you take them big enough so that they're linked, that each chunk is linked very well between each other, so that the actual angle between each chunk is very well determined. If they're linked enough, the angle will be well determined enough. And so if you take them big enough, you're going to act, the angle between them should be between these chunks, should be well determined. And then the conclusion of the theorem says that if basically the standard deviation in the angle between them is small enough compared to the cost is small enough, then your actual so if you take a matrix here, which is basically the scalar product of each chunk with each other, okay, and that gives you a matrix, right? The scalar product between A and B, it gives you this operator here, TAB. So you've got a matrix of operators. Well, if you take any 4x4 submatrix of that matrix, its determinant will be as small as you wish, meaning that if you take any particular four subsections, they're actually almost forming this 3D thing. They're forming that they're as 3D as you want it to be. They're going to be 4D, but they're going to be as 3D, almost into a 3D thing. So it basically means that you're forming a manifold, a 3D manifold, and so you're getting the semi-classical limit from that. And so, to put it mathematically, that's what you get with these definitions. So this is basically this is basically the matrix of the causes.
So kind of just see if I understand.
Yeah.
You have a spatial manifold which is emerging from a coarse grained process in which the angles to the individual coarsely grained units are well.
That's right. And so the fact that the manifold emerges comes from the fact that your angles are well defined. So if your angles are well defined enough, you're getting a manifold, which is a three-dimensional manifold, instead of getting any prop dimensional weird things, right? So you're actually getting something that looks like a manifold.
How does adding links cause the angle to be more well defined?
So when you add links, so for this you caught me on an actual thing, which is the hand waving part. Actually, I don't have that formally. I didn't see that formally anywhere, and didn't write it down for me. So that's actually more hand waving. But so suppose I have a big chunk here, right? Your big chunk, you can always rewrite it through recoupling theory as like this central thing, which will be your thing, and then here you have all these other things which goes out like that. So if I have another one here, J2, like this, okay. If they're linked everywhere, so we know that if there's a direct link going from here to here, then the angle is well defined. If there's one link that's branching, one of the major branches, one here to here, the thing will be well defined, as we saw at the beginning. Now, the more you add links, the more constraints you have as to what the angle has to be. Because every time you're adding a link, you're basically constraining one of the things here to have a definite angle with respect to one here. And this one has a definite angle with one lower down. So you're adding more constraints. And so the more links you will have, my hand waving argument, the more well defined the angle between these two will be. And so if there's enough links between them, the angle should. So if you take these chunks, and this is where it gets even more handy. So hopefully if you take these chunks big enough, there'll be enough links between each of them that each spin of each chunk will be well defined with respect to each other. That's the most handy part.
So as you add more links, you're hoping that in some sense you get a convergent result from the angle.
Yeah. Okay, so pretty much that's in math what I said in English. Alright, so as for the conclusion, so first of all, in this model we have a totally entirely discrete mathematics, even up to that we don't even have a field. Maybe we don't use the real numbers or the complex numbers, so it's entirely discrete, which is very interesting. And the dynamics, and maybe I didn't make that clear enough for myself, the dynamics and the measurement are kind of the same thing in the sense that dynamics is basically adding more things. So suppose I have two J's here, J, K here, and I have a big chunk, right? Dynamics is basically adding more things with certain probability. But if what I do is I add something here, adding more links is basically helping into the measurement of the geometry. I add this thing here, I basically just measured what I did also on top of increasing the dynamics is that I measured exactly the angle between these two by adding this out here. I know the angle exactly between these two. So when you grow, you're actually measuring more of your previous graph. So the dynamics is kind of the same thing as the measurement. So there's something which I left out, which is a very, 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 very big problem. And I'm glad we didn't figure it out. The thing is that, so the actual probabilities here, which I gave in terms of for the dynamics, they're very well defined if you predetermine what will be the shape of the thing that you will add on. So that once you determine the graph which you will add on, then the probabilities of having each label is very well defined, and your dynamics are very well defined. But choosing what shape you will add on right now, there's no method to choose that. I don't know of any method right now to choose that. So, for example, if I have so this thing here, S, and then I have four things here. So if I have this thing here. I can decide, say, that I want to add something of this shape here, like that, to this. And then the probabilities for each labeling of this one and this one are very well defined once I decided I want to add this shape. But what's to tell me that I couldn't have instead done this shape, right? Basically, these two linking in the middle. This one. There's nothing to tell me I couldn't have done that instead or something else. And so at this point, this is not clear. So there is a big problem.
Bunching together over all the possibilities.
Yeah. you could integrate over all possibilities. I guess that's and then you make them equally callable. You can do that.
Actually, if you add them one by one, it's just minus the same as all possibilities.
I mean, one by one, but I mean, so.
Like, define some like minimal element that you add on.
Yeah, so the minimum thing, once you have this, right? You can, so I can, for example, do this, right? Which would be one thing.
Yeah.
But I could also say, do this, so that would be another minimal one.
Yeah, but you need to define some forward, some fundamental principle.
If you have an action principle, then the extreme determines the probability. So as long as you have a path and an element,
yeah, so determines. But there's no action there now, there's no path.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's where it's not complete. Okay, yes, the cool thing is it has modulus and hand waving. It seems to have a semi-classical limit. And after that, so after fixing possible screw things in there, what would be cool would be to manage to generalize it to something which would actually be space-time instead of just directions.
Is this supposed to be like a toy model for quantum gravity?
It's not supposed to be a toy model for quantum gravity, but you can see it as such if you wish. Because, I mean, it's not the same thing, that the ontology is not the same as loop quantum gravity. And
so there's no connection between this theory and gravity,
space time. Yeah. Well, there is in the sense that it's so basically, well, this one has no connection with space time right now, this one has only connection with directions. But if you manage to do it where you have space-time, then there is a connection because you're actually building the space-time.
So there's no connection. You just use loop quantum gravity, which is the quantization of general relativity.
So, I mean, I don't know. That's there's, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be anything wrong. First thing, loop quantum gravity to use something to try out something else. Apart from it's not working, you know, like if it was working. If it was working perfectly.
Well, in fact, in the late 90s, probably I don't know if anyone remembers this, there was an attempt to construct classes of space-time and short-trial geometry using the loop representation, and that work was called Weaves. And so they actually embroidered a classical space-time using loop quantum gravity. This work began in the, I think, 97, disappeared in the late 90s. By 2000, nobody worked with Weaves anymore. And yet, when you describe the semi-classical limit...
No, this is no Weaves at all. No. I'm not.
But when you were describing your technique to get to the semi-classical limit,
yes,
there are a lot of ingredients in common. But it's not the same thing.
No, it's not the same thing. And what
if you were to reopen the question of how to construct Weaves in loop quantum gravity, you might be able to take it to the next level.
Right, so the thing here is that so a new quantum gravity is stuck with your manifold. Which personally I don't like. And with this thing you're not constraining to having a manifold. You're actually building things up from scratch instead of
but gravity has very specific dynamics, right? It's supposed to agree with general relativity.
Yeah, so clearly at some point this you have to try to figure out something which will agree. If it doesn't, then it's
crap. It has to be diffeomorphism.
So this is totally different from the invariant. I mean, there's not even a math rule. So
no, but when you build your classical limit, you get something. I don't want
to. Yeah, you get a manifold. Well, you get something which could be embedded in a manifold, and so therefore, or it could almost be embedded in a manifold, and so therefore, yes, you get. I mean, this thing, the issue of different morphism invariants doesn't even arise here. Because you don't have the manifold.
But it should arise because angles in the space-time change under the action of diffeomorphisms. And yet the angles you described are relational. And your graph is invariant. So your angles are diffeomorphically invariant. But angles you measure in space-time are definitely dependent on your choice of points.
So of course this will not this I mean Lord, you can't talk about Lorentz here because this is not space-time.
Angles are not space-time angles.
Yeah, they're not space-time angles. They're angles. They're not space-time.
Inside your theory.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I mean, until you have the equivalent thing with where your group is something like the Lorentz group or something like that, you can't expect something like what you just said to happen because you don't even have the Lorentz symmetry anything to start with. It doesn't make any sense.
Ever seen.
Yep.
So, I mean, I have just comments about things which I'm worried in that context. So, firstly, I mean, I'm still worried about Lorentz and Lorentz. Supposedly, you have like some semi-classic overlap and you get some black manifold at the end. But we have the Lorentz invariants.
Well, right now, you can't have Lorentz invariants for sure because you right now.
Yeah, that's so free in there.
So right now you have SO3 global SO3 invariants.
Yeah.
And
you can just big rotate one of the directions and then you have the SO2 normal one.
Whoa, no, well, SO2 normal one, yeah.
Okay.
But it won't be flat. Like, it'll be locally flat, but not. Well, not locally flat. Let's see. It will be locally. It will look locally. Like RN, right? But it won't be flat. So basically, that the thing is that it's locally such a dimensional thing, but it's not. There's nothing which makes it to be flat.
Yeah. Well, actually, that brings me to my second concern. Yeah. Is that a smart person told me once that well, something which I didn't understand in all detail, but specifically, you can basically put a UV divergent theory on a lattice, and it will be. Master what we have because you have put in a cutoff, and then if you want to have some emergent kind of classical limit, you will run into problems that you typically don't find an emergent classical limit.
I didn't get your last point. You don't find an emerging classical limit. So right here, you find something very close to an emerging classical limit.
Yeah, so maybe, so what I wanted to say is that maybe there's still some caveats involved.
Yeah, definitely, it might be. So I mean, I didn't investigate this entirely, so there might be, yes.
I mean, it's just
because
the conservative doesn't have like an emerging classical limit, because they don't even know what you want to.
So maybe
the same thing will happen there.
Just these
adjust the
signal. Did you mention how you get distances? Yeah, so the distances here is also another problem. It's not clear that there is a distances, and if there is, it's not clear how you get them. So and yeah, so probably to get the distances, you need to use another loop. That might be a possibility instead of just a rotation loop. And therefore, I mean, to generalize it to the whole space time, maybe it's not the Lorentz group you need to use, but the Poincaré group or something like that. So,
okay.
And if you want to have distances, it might be that you need to use the rotation plus translation.
Yeah, well, can't you use some assumption of some flatness, some embedding in some flat space to define the.
No, I don't want to use embedding in flat space. Unless it somehow emerges.
to define distances.
So embedding doesn't define distances.
No, but you know relational angles.
Yeah. So I mean, like one thing which you could do, for example, if you use this thing here, then you could say okay, right. You can say, okay, this thing here is at this angle of this one, and this thing here is this long, and then you kind of somehow have a notion of distances, and you can you know kind of build it up from there. You have this kind of quantum space, which is not necessarily well defined, but very.
You have the same label everywhere.
Yeah.
Basically, the space would be spatially flat, spatially Minkowski, simply because it's the same everywhere. Could be
considered.
Let's just think about.
It won't necessarily. Yeah.
Sometimes you're saying everywhere, it's homogeneous and isotropic, so you've got a spatially flat section.
You're making it homogeneous. You're like making it into.
I'm choosing the same spin, everywhere. Same label everywhere.
The same label everywhere. But the graph might not be regular. Like the graph.
Let's say we're trying to construct the Minkowski space. So the question
remains,
it takes 20 seconds to finish this question. If you construct the Minkowski space by spins the same everywhere,
can you calculate an angle that's our distance from an origin and prove it's 2 pi? Prove that you're in the calculus.
And because you add the angles add up to 2 pi or something.
Well, it only adds up to 2 pi in the calculus.
So I know that, for example, if you do the particular thing that you do, yeah, I think you do. So even like so on locally, on the very local level, it's been like no matter what you put here.
Yeah,
locally it will be
yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah. But so if you have this, if you build a particular analysis, you get the proper angles between all the. So yeah, I think you will get to find it. On a local level, on a local level.
The answer is 2 pi regardless of your choices. Right?
Yes.
But that's a really interesting question. That is a good answer.
Oh, okay. Okay, you mean like if you go like really far, do you get. Yeah, I don't know.
Locally pi is pi, but globally pi is pi.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then globally, if you go far away, I think that's something to.
Which I have a metric, you know exactly what the pi is.
All right, so I'm going to do this. But we should talk about that. So thank you, Isabel. Next talk tomorrow morning, very early.